them, Oskim said, and a triple blast of concentrated laser fire joined the stream of plasma spheres. Arlani considered Oskim one of the best weapons officers in the expansionary defense fleet, and he did his best. Even at their marginal range, he managed to get 3 clean hits on the repair dock as it moved clear of the station. But they were too far out for any significant damage. A minute later, the dock and both patrol ships escaped into hyperspace.
Sorry, Admiral.
Oskim apologized as the laser fire ceased.
Not your fault,
Arlani assured him, as the plasmasphere launchers also went silent.
The priority now is to get to the station and dismantle or destroy whatever bomb or bombs they put aboard before they can wake up. Utrol, get 2 shuttles prepped and loaded.
Horn in, Admiral,
Utro said, punching orders into her Questus.
Don't worry, we'll get there in time.
Arlani looked out the viewport. And if they didn't, she reminded herself soberly, everyone aboard those shuttles would probably die. She could only hope that whatever secret was lurking inside that battered hull was worth the risk. Arlani had been concerned that their attackers might have had time to set several bombs aboard the wrecked Nicardoon base before fleeing. Fortunately, there was only one very large one. Even more fortunately, it remained dormant, frozen by the massive ion storm the Vigilant had hit it with until the Chiss techs were able to get aboard and disarm it. It was as the survey teams worked their way through the station that Arlani finally realized what had been nagging at her.
There,
she said, pointing to one of the images being sent back to the ship by the survey teams.
That blast point. A single close-range shot. Just enough to break through the hull and depressurize the compartment. But not so much as to make the damage a lengthy pain in the neck to repair,
Utro said thoughtfully.
So after their sneak attack asteroid missile blew in the front door, and a few follow-up missiles popped open the command and control areas, they charged in and just poked holes in the walls until everyone inside was dead. And then continued the same pattern in the interior,
Arlani said, pointing to another set of images.
Their plan all along was to kill the Nicardoon who were running the base, make enough of a mess to convince any passers-by that they had gone away, then slink back after everyone left and put the station back together. Because why would anyone ever come back for a second look at a place that was obviously useless?
Utro agreed.
So most of the debris out there was just for show? I doubt that,
Arlani said.
The Nicardoon probably had a fair number of ships here, both visiting and standing guard. That's where all the wreckage came from.
Right,
Utro said.
Which makes this, what, some kind of fueling stop that you've wanted to downplay?
No, I think it was more than that,
Arlani said, a shiver running through her.
I think this base was set up as a rendezvous and coordination point for Yiv's people and their allies.
Well, I don't remember any allies showing up at the Primea battle,
Utro said.
You think we in the Vex just wiped out the Nicardoon before Yiv had time to bring any new forces into play?
Or they were never intended to be brought in,
Arlani said.
Not the base's location. Hidden and out of the way, but relatively close to sunrise.
And between sunrise and the ascendancy,
Utro pointed out.
That too,
Arlani agreed.
An ideal spot for someone who wanted to keep an eye on either us or the Magus's people.
Or both,
Utro said.
At least that explains why we kept seeing the same battle dreadnought at sunrise. This was also probably going to be their repair and refurbishing center.
only they don't yet have it up and running.
That was my thought, too, Arlani said, nodding.
I'm guessing they didn't expect us to find Sunrise as quickly as we did.
Which only happened because Thrawn met the mages and the refugees and decided to play a hunch,
Uhtred murmured.
That's going to frost some people.
Thrawn's ability to frost the Alistocra is hardly new, Arlani pointed out. Regardless, the fact that the same asteroid missile launcher trick was used in both places adds additional confirmation that the people we tangled with over Sunrise are the same ones who hit this base.
Plus the other Nikkar Dune base we checked out before this one,
Uhtred reminded her.
Can't be a coincidence that both were hit.
She lifted a finger for emphasis.
Something else occurs to me. You called them allies a minute ago. But for them to come in and wipe out two different Nikkar Dune bases?
You're right,
Arlani said, feeling her lip twitch.
The Nikkar Dune weren't the attacker's allies. They were just their tools. And you don't destroy a good tool unless you have something better at hand.
Or unless you think that particular tool is about to break,
Uhtred said.
I wonder if they know Thrawn took General Yiv alive.
Interesting question, Arlani said.
We might want to suggest a couple of new topics for the Council's interrogators.
Assuming we make it back to Chile in one piece,
Uhtred warned.
Even if this base isn't open for business, those patrol ships may have friends in the area.
Excellent point,
Arlani said, touching her command chair's comm key.
Survey leader?
I'm here, Admiral, Bicleon's voice came back. We just found another equipment dump. That makes at least four of them, and we're not even quite done yet.
Actually, you are,
Arlani said. I have the sense we're close to overstaying our welcome.
How long will it take to make recordings of this latest dump?
If you don't want any additions to the physical evidence we already sent to the Vigilant, we can have it done in 15 minutes,
Bicleon said.
If you want a sampling, it'll take another hour.
Just make the recordings, Arlani said. I think we have enough crates to keep the Nebarar techs happy. Pass the word to the other teams that they're to finish up and get back to their shuttles. I want to be back in hyperspace in 40 minutes.
Yes, ma'am, Bicleon said. We'll be there.
Arlani keyed off the comm.
You all heard,
she added, raising her voice to include the rest of the bridge.
Hyperspace in 40 minutes.
Hyperspace in 40 minutes,
Uhtred acknowledged, keying the order into her Questus.
Do you want me to go get Abbeg? I assume you want her to handle the first leg of the trip home.
Definitely, Arlani said. But there's no rush on that. You can leave her in her suite for another half hour.
Right,
Uhtred said dryly.
We wouldn't want her to get bored.
I'm not worried about boredom,
Arlani said grimly, looking across the bridge at the tactical display.
As you said, those patrol ships may have friends.
Many years ago, when Senior Captain Zodlakin Daro first joined the Expansionary Defense Fleet, there had been an elaborate ceremony to celebrate her rematching from her birth family to the Zodlak family. Lakinda didn't remember much about the ritual, except that it was big and flashy and completely overwhelmed her simple commoner tastes. Today's rematching, she suspected, would be far less extravagant. Not because being rematched from one of the 40 great families to one of the 9 ruling families wasn't a big deal, because it most certainly was, but because all the flurry of activity in the wake of the fiasco out in the Hoxsim system was taking up the majority of everyone's focus today. Which was fine with her. Most people who were offered such a social step up, she knew, would grab at it with both hands, moving into their new position without so much as a glance backward. But while Lakinda recognized the honor that was being given to her by the Arisi family, she couldn't help feeling a certain guilt over her abandonment of the Zodlak. They'd taken her out of obscurity, after all, and she'd always believed that such a gesture should be repaid with loyalty. Of course, she'd never expected any other family to want her enough to try to rematch her, so she'd never taken the time to really think it through. But now, that had happened. Moreover, the Arisi offer had been extremely generous. Raising her, as it did, from merit adoptive of the Zodlak to trial-born of the Arisi. And the friends she'd consulted with had unanimously recommended she take it. So, here she was in Chaplar, capital city of the Ascendancy, walking through the Convocate Hall toward the central sindicure offices of the Arisi family. It was the best move for her, she told herself firmly. Whatever guilt she might feel was an artifice of her own mind, to be ignored until it eventually faded away. Or so she hoped. The ceremony, as expected, was short and slightly distracted. Speaker Irizi Imo Lakfo took her to his office, where the witnesses were waiting, declared her rematched from the Zodlak to the Arisi, ran her through an oath where she and the family declared their mutual loyalty, then congratulated her on her new position. The single pang of guilt she felt during the oath was quickly brushed aside by the flurry of data work that the speaker then proceeded to hand her. 30 minutes after her arrival, she left. No longer Senior Captain Zodlakandaro, but now Senior Captain Irisiandaro.
Zainda.
She repeated her new corps name over and over in her mind as she strode back down the corridor toward the shuttle landing area. It sounded pleasantly exotic, but it was definitely going to take some getting used to.
Zainda. Zainda.
Senior Captain Zainda,
a voice called from behind her. Even with all her preparation, it took a good second and a half before her brain caught up with the fact that she was the person being called to.
Oh, yes,
she replied, stopping and turning around. The woman striding toward her wasn't anyone she recognized, but the blue-red thin-stripe outer-wrap robe, with its dark red sleeves and black filigree, was a combination she knew all too well. Adding in the distinctive speaker shoulder band,
"Senior Captain Zainda,"
the woman repeated.
"I am she,"
Zainda said, her heart sinking as her dormant guilt surged back to the surface.
"I am Speaker Zodlak Provomtivti,"
the woman said stiffly as she strode up to Zainda, stopping barely half a meter away.
"I'd hoped to catch you before you met with Speaker Zebol. I see I'm too late."
"Yes,"
Zainda said.
"Can I help you?"
For a moment, Lakprovom just stared at her. Zainda forced herself to meet the other's gaze, silently ordering herself not to be intimidated. Speaker Lakprovom might be the Sindicure's highest-ranking Zodlak, but Zainda was Arisi now, and the Zodlak hierarchy no longer meant anything to her.
"I hoped I could offer incentives for you to stay with our family,"
Lakprovom said at last.
"I understand the Patriarch was somewhat offended that you didn't tell anyone of the Arisi offer before accepting it."
"I'm sorry if I broke protocol,"
Zainda said, knowing full well that she'd done nothing of the sort. A person who'd been offered rematching could speak to their current family if they chose to do so, but it was certainly not required.
"But I felt it was time to move on."
"Why?"
Lakprovom asked bluntly.
"Did the Arisi offer a higher status? We could have matched it.
Did they offer money or land or a position?
None of those was the deciding factor,
Zyanda said. So, Lac-Brevant wanted to be blunt? Fine. Zyanda could be blunt, too.
I knew my time with the Zodlak was nearing an end when my first officer aboard the family frigate Midsummer relieved me of command and got away with that act of mutiny because he was blood.
Family rank isn't supposed to be a factor on naval ships, Lac-Brevant said.
You weren't listening,
Zyanda said.
This wasn't an expansionary defense fleet ship. This was a family ship.
Lac-Brevant's glare slipped a little. Maybe she'd skimmed the Hoxim report a little too quickly.
That's no excuse, she said. No one of Zodlak blood should use his or her position that way. I certainly wouldn't have.
I'm glad to hear it,
Zyanda said.
The fact remains that this one did. If you'll excuse me, I'm expected back on my ship.
I apologize on behalf of the family,
Lac-Brevant said as Zyanda started to turn away.
I'll see to it that he is properly reprimanded.
As you wish,
Zyanda said, turning back to her.
But only as you yourself wish. The internal workings of the Zodlak family no longer concern me.
This time, when Zyanda turned away, Lac-Brevant remained silent. Perhaps that last jab had been unnecessary, Zyanda thought, as she continued down the corridor. Perhaps it had even been a bit childish, but she had to admit that it had felt good. But really, wasn't that what family politics and relationships were all about? Give or take, win or lose, deliver the jab or receive it? That was how it had always been. That was how it would always be. No matter the family, certainly no matter the individual people, it was the Chiss way, and it would never change.
Memories 1.
Of all the duties foisted on low-ranking family members, Aristocra Mithrasophis had often heard the task of welcoming new merit adoptives to their formal rematching dinner was one of the worst. The newcomers were either highly skilled additions to the myth, in which case they tended to have an overblown opinion of themselves and their value, or they were freshly initiated into the Ascendancy military, in which case they were self-conscious and, well, extremely military. Nearly all of the blood, cousins, and ranking distance opted out of the reception duty, leaving most of the burden to fall on trialborns and other merit adoptives, none of whom had enough pull to avoid it. Which made Thras a definite anomaly, because, unlike practically everyone else in his circle of friends, he genuinely enjoyed the service. Of course, he'd only been doing it for the past 3 years, and in that time he'd only welcomed 11 merit adoptives. Maybe after a couple more years, the excitement of meeting and evaluating new people would fade, and he would become as cynical and world-weary as everyone else. But he doubted it. Every one of these people had been approved by the Patriarch's office, a fair percentage of them by the Patriarch himself. And Thras liked to see if he could figure out what made each of them special in the family's eyes. This one, for example, the young man freshly renamed Mithron Yuru, was standing inside the reception room, looking around the walls at the Avidich landscape paintings and the corner statuettes representing or created by some of the ancient myth patriarchs. To Thras's eye, he looked just a bit lost. A fairly common reaction from someone who'd been rematched from a nondescript family on a minor world into one of the greatest of the Ascendancy's 9 ruling families. Thrawn was wearing the uniform of a Taharim Academy cadet,
which meant he'd been taken from his home directly to Naparar and then been brought here to Avidich for his welcome and orientation.
Thras frowned.
For new warriors, it usually went the other way around. First to Avidich, and then to Naparar. Apparently, someone in the family had wanted him signed into the expansionary defense fleet as quickly as possible, before even his formal welcoming. Hopefully, he wouldn't look as intimidated in the heat of battle as he did in a grand ruling family reception room. The one common attribute of ascendancy military types was their outward confidence. The younger man turned as Thras walked in through the archway.
Cadet Mithron Yuru?
Thras asked formally.
I am he,
Thron said.
Welcome to Avidich, Thras said. I'm Aristokra Mithrasophis. I'll be guiding you through the various protocols that will fully and officially rematch you to the Mith family.
He waved a hand to encompass the room.
And try not to be overwhelmed by all the fancy flourishes and curlicues. This reception room is also where dignitaries and emissaries from other families are brought in. And we like to make sure right from the start that they know who they're dealing with.
I wasn't intimidated,
Thron said mildly.
I was merely noting the unusual fact that the same artist who did three of the landscapes also created two of the statuettes. It's uncommon for a single artist to excel at both artistic forms.
Thras looked around. He'd been in this room dozens of times and had twice visited the Chila homestead's collection of official family art. And as far as he could remember, none of them had visible signatures or other identifiers. In fact, that was the whole point of these displays. These were myth artworks, to be seen as coming not from individuals, but from the family as a whole. So how did Thron know which pieces had been done by which artist?
Which ones?
Thras asked.
Show me.
Those three landscapes,
Thron said, pointing.
And those statuettes?
He indicated a pair in one of the corners. Thras stepped over for a closer look. Just as he'd remembered, there was nothing to indicate the artist on any of them.
What makes you think they're by the same person?
Thron's forehead furrowed in a frown.
They just are,
he said, sounding a little confused.
The lines, the color, the material mix. It's...
His lips compressed briefly.
Obvious,
Thras suggested. Thron looked like he was going to agree, then seemed to think better of it.
It's difficult to explain,
he said instead.
Well, let's find out,
Thras said, pulling out his questus. The artwork here might not be labeled, but the specific artists were surely listed in the archives.
Anything else you can tell me about them?
He added, as he started the search.
The artist's height or favorite foods, maybe?
No, neither,
Thron admitted. If he'd noticed Thras's little joke, he didn't show it.
But I believe a personal or family tragedy may have occurred between the creation of these two.
He pointed to two of the landscapes, one showing a churning ocean tide pool, the other with a snow-capped mountain jutting into the sky.
Actually, the tragedy may predate all of the pieces, except the one with the tide pool. I also have the sense that the artist was a woman. But that's just an impression, not a solid conclusion.
Why that impression?
Thras asked, peering at his questus. There was the listing. Now to sort through and tag the five pieces Thron had specified.
It's something about the line and edging,
Thron said.
But, as I say, I don't claim that's necessarily accurate.
I understand,
Thras said, suppressing a smile. Though, of course, an assertion like that did give him a 50-50 chance. His hidden smile became a hidden grimace. Earlier, he told himself he would never get cynical about meeting newcomers to the family. Was he breaking that promise already? The listing came up. He stared at the Questus. No. It wasn't possible.
Is there trouble?
Thrawn asked. Thras threw a hooded look at him. No. There was no way the cadet could have simply looked at the works and come to those conclusions. He must have dug into the archives himself in advance. Except that there were hundreds of thousands of Myth family artworks, and they were rotated frequently among the various family holdings and official offices. The odds that these particular ones would be on display in this particular reception room at this particular time were practically non-existent. He took a careful breath.
You're right,
he said, forcing his voice to stay calm. A Myth cousin had no business reacting in even moderate awe to a freshly chosen merit adoptive.
All five were created by the legendary 12th patriarch, Mythomoros Odo, sometimes called the Tragic. All four of her sons died in battle.
He pulled up her bio and did a quick comparison of the dates.
3 months after the Tidepool piece.
All four,
Thrawn murmured, looking again at the landscape.
A terrible loss, indeed.
According to the archives, she was determined not to let it influence her rule,
Thras continued.
But that mountain landscape was the last piece she ever did. Or at least the last surviving one.
I can understand that,
Thrawn said.
An artist of such skill and self-awareness might well have seen how the scars of memory had affected her inspiration and resolved to put her artwork aside until she could regain her former tranquility.
Thras winced.
Only she never did, he murmured.
No, Thrawn said softly. Some losses run too deep to ever fully heal.
Thras studied his face, noting the fresh tension lines in his cheeks and throat.
You sound like you've had experience.
Thrawn shrugged slightly.
No more than many others in the Ascendancy have suffered, he said,
the tension lines smoothing out. Though it took a conscious effort, Thras saw. Whatever pain was lurking behind those eyes, it wasn't going away anytime soon. But that sort of ache wasn't for public display. It certainly wasn't for a new acquaintance to casually poke at. If life had taught Thras anything, it was to respect others' privacy.
I'm sorry to hear that,
he said, gesturing toward the door.
Perhaps a discussion for another day. Let me show you to your room. Dinner's in 3 hours, and you may want to practice your part of the ceremony.
The rematching dinner was, as always, a grand and, in Thras's private opinion, slightly over-pompous ceremony. Still, it was traditional, and the guests and attending dignitaries alike all seemed suitably impressed and happy. Thrawn possibly being the one exception. He was seated on the other side of the long table and several people down. And Thras couldn't hear any of what he was saying. He seemed to be holding his own, fielding questions put to him by his neighbors, and those conversational partners all seemed satisfied with his answers. At least none of them rolled their eyes or turned away from the young man in revulsion. But Thrawn also never seemed to initiate any conversations of his own. Mostly, he sat and ate in silence, watching and listening to everything going on around him.
Once, Thras caught him looking at the row of tapestries lining the grand banquet hall, his eyes moving slowly from one to another.
The welcoming ceremony also went well. Thrawn held his own there, too, speaking his lines correctly and with the proper solemnity.
But to Thras's eye, he still seemed uncomfortable.
Perhaps not surprisingly, Thrawn was by far the youngest of tonight's 30 rematches, and in his simple cadet's uniform, he looked rather out of place beside the junior commander and mid-captain who were also being welcomed into the family. The ceremony had been over for half an hour, and the open conversation time well underway before Thras was finally able to catch up to the younger man.
"Though you've now heard this at least a dozen times, welcome to the myth," he said in greeting. "May I offer a drink of family kinship?"
"Thank you," Thrawn said. "I have to say, this isn't like anything I've ever experienced."
"I'm not surprised," Thras said, steering them toward the nearest drink station. "The myth are famous for our ceremonies. How long are you staying on Avidich?"
"Just one night," Thrawn said. "I was given special dispensation to come here, and I can't afford to be away any longer than necessary."
"Sounds rather petty to me,"
Thras said with a sniff, snagging two of the drinks and handing one to Thrawn.
"Coming all the way here, only to turn around and hurry back? What would extending your leave an extra day really cost? 2 down marks? 3? We could probably even get them cancelled."
"I appreciate the offer," Thrawn said. "But since I'm already working off 50, I don't think..."
50?
Thras felt his eyes widen.
"What in the world did you do?"
"I was caught where I wasn't supposed to be during the voyage from Rentor,"
Thrawn said, a little ruefully.
"I'm not even sure why I'm here tonight. Surely my rematching ceremony could have waited another few weeks."
"On that one, at least, I can enlighten you,"
Thras said, feeling rather proud of himself for having figured it out during dinner.
"See that woman over there, wearing the violet outer wrap robe with the pale blue trim? That's the Irisi Patriel for Avidich. The local Patriels are always invited to these ceremonies, though usually they're too busy to attend. But the Irisi generally at least send a representative."
"Interesting," Thrawn said, as he sipped at his drink. "I was told the Myth and Irisi were rivals."
"That's rather like saying Chila is cold," Thras said dryly. "No, their attendance is less courtesy and more wanting to keep tabs on what we're up to. At any rate, one of their goals in life is to get as many of their people into the Defense Force and General Barkeef's new expansionary defense fleet as they can. And our Patriarch decided he'd rather have 3 military rematches to unveil than 2. A quick word to Colonel Weavery, a one-day travel pass, and here you are."
"I see,"
Thrawn said, the frown on his face suggesting that he didn't see at all.
"But that's politics," Thras continued. "I'm just sorry you can't stay longer. The Patriel's art collection is hardly to the standard of the Chila homestead, but it's excellent in its own right. I'd hoped to give you the grand tour and see what other details you could glean from the pieces."
"That would be most enjoyable,"
Thrawn said, an odd hesitation in his tone.
"It wasn't a demand," Thras assured him. "Only if you'd like to."
"Oh, I would," Thrawn said. "It's simply... your blood, are you not?"
"I'm a cousin,"
Thras corrected. The first few times he'd made that assertion, he remembered distantly he'd felt a certain level of guilt. Now it didn't bother him at all, though it was clearly bothering Thrawn. not a surprise, really. Given the cadet's current low ranking and how seriously newcomers to the family took the unspoken rules regarding proper etiquette.
But a difference in our status doesn't mean we can't talk or look at artwork together, he added.
I understand,
Thrawn said. Again, Thras sensed that he really didn't.
Someday, perhaps, you can give me that tool. But for now, I really should retire for the night. My flight leaves early.
Of course, Thras said. Sleep well, Cadet Thrawn, and safe travels. I trust we'll meet again.
I hope so, Aristocra Thras.
Thrawn's lip twitched in a rather self-conscious smile.
For the next 2 years, at least, you'll know exactly where to find me.
I don't get to Naperar very often, Thras said. But if I'm ever there, I'll be certain to look you up.
Thank you, Thrawn said. Good night.
Good night.
For a minute, Thras watched as Thrawn made his way across the reception room floor, weaving past the conversational groups with a grace that contrasted starkly with his less nimble conversational and social skills. The man was definitely an odd docklet. But at least he was an interesting odd docklet. So few odd docklets were. It might be worth a few minutes every now and again to pull up the cadet's Tahrim records and see how he was doing. In the meantime, there were other people here that a myth cousin ought to at least say hello to.
Starting, unfortunately, with a haughty Irizi Patriel over there.
Picking up another drink for fortification,
he headed through the crowd.
And as he did so, he found himself looking at the tapestries and paintings adorning the room, wondering what exactly Thrawn had seen in them.
Chapter 2.
A week ago, Mithurfian Eco mused, when he'd been merely Syndic Prime Thurfian, he'd been accustomed to rising every morning at 6. Now, as Patriarch Thurfian, the most powerful person in the Myth family, his workday was beginning a full 2 hours earlier.
It will get easier, your Venerante,
Senior Aide Mithif Iklo assured him as he sent yet another stack of files to Thurfian's Questus.
I remember Patriarch Thuraki getting up every day at 4 o'clock when he first became head of the family. But after a couple of years, he was able to sleep until 5:30.
Really?
Thurfian said, eyeing him. Thavik had been with the Patriarch's office a long time, but he didn't look that old.
I didn't know you were with him that early in his administration.
Oh, I wasn't with the Patriarch directly,
Thavik said.
I was merely an aide to one of his officials. But we all talked together.
Of course,
Thurfian said, briefly wondering what the officials, aides, and assistants were saying about their newest superior. Nothing very complimentary, he suspected. Patriarch Thuraki had been a strong and effective leader, well-liked by his staff and most of the senior myth officials. He'd cast a long, wide shadow across both the family and the Ascendancy, and it would be a long time before Thurfian or anyone else would even come close to filling that shadow. Maybe that was one reason why the Speaker and Patriels had all turned down the position and instead nominated Thurfian for it. He could only hope it wasn't their only reason.
Your 9 o'clock appointment has also arrived, Thavik continued. He's waiting in the main anteroom.
Thank you,
Thurfian said, frowning at him. The words had been perfectly proper, but there'd been just a hint of a disapproving tone beneath them.
Is there a problem?
Of course not, your Venerante,
Thavik assured him.
You're the Patriarch. You may meet with whomever you wish.
Only why am I meeting with Nerezi Syndic?
Thurfian prompted. Thavik hesitated.
You may meet with whomever you wish, he repeated,
this time with clear reluctance.
It merely seems to me that you send a strange message by seeing one of our adversaries before you've even met with all of our own Patriels and counselors.
An interesting point,
Thurfian agreed.
Did it occur to you that I might want to send a strange message? That I might want to signal to the Arisi and the Ascendancy in general that we may be entering a new era of cooperation between families?
Your Fenerante, that's...
Thavik broke off, his throat working as he seemed to search for words.
Our rivalry with the Arisi extends far into the past on both sides.
Perhaps it's time we revisited that rivalry, Thurfian said.
Your Venerante...
Which isn't to say that I'm going to be handing over the keys to the homestead,
Thurfian continued.
I intend to make it clear that if we're to reconcile with the Arisi, it will be on our terms, not theirs.
I see,
Thavik said, his earlier composure starting to creep back into place.
Yes, I... Naturally, you're the one who makes such decisions.
Yes, I am,
Thurfian said softly.
Please show Syndic Arisi Stalmustro in.
Yes, your Fenerante.
Bowing, Thavik turned and hurried from the office, his posture somehow conveying relief, subservience, and a hint of lingering concern. It was a lot to pack into such a compact package, Thurfian noted, as the senior aide closed the door behind him. Surface obedience with underlying disapproval. Briefly, he wondered how long it had taken Thavik to master that particular combination. He was sifting through the second of Thavik's new set of files when the door opened again, and Thavik silently ushered Syndic Sistalmu into the office.
Ah, Syndic Sistalmu,
Thurfian greeted him, motioning him forward toward the guest chair at the corner of the desk.
Thank you for coming. Please, sit down.
Thank you, Patriarch Thurfian,
Sistalmu said, his tone and expression cautious as he crossed to the chair and eased himself into it.
May I begin by congratulating you on your new position as head of the Meath family? Your Patriarchs have shown great wisdom and foresight in choosing Patriarch Thuraki's successor.
Thank you,
Thurfian said, inclining his head and looking past Sistalmu at Thavik, still standing by the open door.
That will be all, Senior Aide.
Yes, Your Venerante,
Thavik said, bowing again. He backed out of the room, once again closing the door behind him. Thurfian looked back at Sistalmu.
What you mean, I presume,
he suggested with a wry smile,
is how in the Ascendancy do the Patriarchs accidentally trip over you on their way to choosing a real Patriarch?
I wouldn't put it in exactly those terms,
Sistalmu said, some of the tension leaving his face.
I did mean the congratulations part, though.
Thank you,
Thurfian said. Technically, of course, Sistalmu should be addressing him as Your Venerante now that he was a Patriarch. But given their history together, Thurfian was willing to let it slide.
And you are now...
Sistalmu gave a small shrug.
Syndic Prime,
he said.
I thought so,
Thurfian said.
The dynamics I was seeing at the last full Syndicure assembly. But that's neither here nor there. Congratulations in turn.
Thank you,
Sistalmo said.
I presume you invited me here to tell me that our plan to bring down Thrawn has ended?
On the contrary,
Thurfian said grimly.
I called you here to see if you knew what in blazes went down 2 weeks ago among the Zodlat, Pomrio, and Aragol families out at that useless planet.
Hoxim,
Sistalmo supplied the name.
At least that's what Counselor Lukuviv called it at his interrogation. All we know is that there was supposedly a rich Nyx mine there, and that he sent Zodlak family ships to go seize it. All for the greater good of the Ascendancy, of course. I'm told he repeated that defense at least 4 times.
Of course.
What happened after they arrived there is... let's just say it's muddled.
But we know that Thrawn was somehow involved.
Isn't he always?
Sistalmo asked sourly.
We also know that the mine was obliterated, apparently having been landed on by a crashing freighter.
Convenient,
Thurfian muttered.
Very...
Sistalmo agreed.
I presume Thrawn isn't talking.
Not anyone we have connections with,
Thurfian said.
And that includes Supreme General Barkeef's office.
Ditto for us,
Sistalmo said.
I take it you hadn't heard any of the details.
Thurfian shook his head.
None of our allies was involved. And everyone's being very quiet.
Yes. You'd think they all had something to hide,
Sistalmo said.
I'd hoped we might be able to pry some more information from Senior Captain Sainda, but she's been as close-mouthed as everyone else.
Sainda?
Senior Captain Irizindaro,
Sistalmo said.
Formerly... Zodlak Indaro. Her rematching to the Irizi was formalized 3 days ago.
Ah,
Thurfian said, nodding. He remembered reading that a senior captain, Lukenda, had been in command of the Zodlak force at Hoxim, but hadn't realized the Irizi had snatched her away from that family.
You have an interesting approach to intel gathering.
Thank you,
Sistalmo said.
Freshly minted member of one of the nine. A very family-oriented woman, proud and exhilarated and anxious to please. It was worth a shot.
But it didn't work.
As I said, close-mouthed.
Sistalmo shrugged again.
Still, even without that... She's an excellent officer. Well worth taking into the family.
So her record would indicate.
Thurfian agreed. Though taking someone from one of your allies, he knew, could sometimes be tricky. If the Zodlak Patriarch decided he was insulted by Zyenda's rematching, it could cool relations between them and the Irizi. On the other hand... Given the undefined but clearly unpleasant aftermath the Zodlak currently found themselves in, he doubted that complaints about losing even a senior expansionary defense fleet officer would be high on the Zodlak priority list.
So mostly all I know is the official story,
Sistalmo continued.
3 of the 40 sent family ships out to this Hoxim system, and ended up fighting a group of alien gunboats that had somehow caught the Springhawk in an ambush.
Plus the fact that a Nyx mine was involved.
That part, I think, everyone knows,
Sistalmo said sourly.
It's about the only excuse for their behavior that all 3 families can point to.
For whatever it's worth,
Thurfinn said.
You believe that bit about an ambush?
Zistalmu snorted.
Of course not. Thrawn caught in a trap? Not a chance.
So, in other words, Thrawn has again skated to the edge and managed to hold his balance,
Thurfinn said.
Only this time it wasn't just military targets that were involved. This time he dragged in the 40, with every bit of the messiness you'd expect. And, for once, came out of it with nothing to show.
Maybe. Maybe not,
Zistalmu said darkly.
There are rumors that the Springhawk stopped by Sposia on its way to Chila.
Thurfinn felt his eyes narrow.
The UAG?
So says the rumor,
Zistalmu said.
Whether or not it's true...
He shrugged again. Thurfinn scowled down at his questus. The Universal Analysis Group on Sposia was the clearinghouse where all alien artifacts and technology collected by the Ascendancy were taken to be studied. Most of the historical pieces eventually went to museums or art collections, while most of the technological items proved too damaged or fragmentary to be of any use and were either catalogued into storage chambers or simply destroyed. But every so often, a piece of technology was found that was complete enough to be studied. Those rare items were taken to a special underground complex, where teams of scientists and techs worked painstakingly to coax out their secrets. And occasionally, very occasionally, one of those was deemed of military value and moved to Vault 4. The gravity well generator Thrawn had stolen from the Vagari pirates was somewhere in that work complex. So was the immensely powerful Republic shield generator he'd taken from the Separatist base at the edge of Lesser Space and used against General Yiv. So, once, had been the device called Starflash.
I keep having this disturbing image,
Zistalmu continued.
An entire UAG wing dedicated solely to Thrawn's findings.
I wouldn't doubt it,
Thurfinn said.
You'll recall we've speculated once or twice that someone high in either the Sindicure or the Defense Hierarchy Council has been protecting Thrawn from the repercussions of his political blunders. Maybe that artifact wing is the reason.
I don't know,
Zistalmu said doubtfully.
The UAG is mostly the province of the Stibler family, and they don't have anywhere near enough pull with either the Sindicure or the Council. If I had to guess, I'd say it was Patriarch Thuraki who was Thrawn's primary defender.
Perhaps,
Thurfinn murmured.
In which case, you may now have the power to finally get rid of him.
Zistalmu tilted his head slightly.
If you still want to.
If I hadn't already been convinced that was necessary, the fiasco at Hoxim would have done it,
Thurfinn said heavily.
The question is still how.
Yes,
Zistalmu said, nodding.
Good.
Thurfinn frowned.
What do you mean, good?
I mean,
Zistalmu said,
from your new position, the solution to the Thrawn problem is obvious. You simply petition the Defense Hierarchy Council to promote Thrawn to Commodore.
And put him in a position where he can cause even more damage?
Thurfinn cut in.
Are you serious?
Thereby removing him from the myth,
Zistalmu continued calmly.
And guaranteeing the family name won't be tarnished when he finally falls from grace.
I hardly think I would find solace in Myth family honor remaining intact if the Ascendancy itself had fallen,
Thurfian said stiffly.
I agree,
Sistalmu said.
I just wasn't sure you did. As I said, good.
For a long moment, the two men locked eyes. Then, Thurfian took a deep breath.
So you trust me now?
Sistalmu shrugged.
More than I did when I walked in here today. So, we take him down?
Yes,
Thurfian said.
I don't know how yet, but we do.
Well, we can start by figuring out what happened at Hoxim,
Sistalmu said, standing up.
I'll get back to the Sindicure and start digging. I assume you still have a lot of pomp and ceremony to go through?
More than I like, yes,
Thurfian conceded.
But as soon as all of that is over, I'll start looking at what options I have as Patriarch.
All right.
Sistalmu smiled slightly.
I suppose we won't be meeting anymore in the March of Silence.
What we give up in secrecy and convenience, we make up in comfort,
Thurfian said, giving him a same-sized smile in return.
The food is better, too, if and when we have enough time to sample it. Let me know when you have something, and we'll set up another meeting.
I will,
Sistalmu said.
And once again, congratulations.
Thurfian gazed at the door a moment after he left, sifting through the bits of data Sistalmu had given him, then turned back to his questus. He was in the middle of Thavik's third file when the senior aide returned.
Has he gone?
Thurfian asked. Thavik nodded.
He and his escort are on their way back to Chaplar, he said. I must also soon head in that direction.
Your trip to Naperar?
Yes, your Venerante, Thavik said. Your credentials must be officially presented to the expansionary defense fleet.
Understood,
Thurfian said. Thavik had already made a similar trip to the Defense Force, but their headquarters were only a couple of thousand kilometers away, outside the capital, an easy trip by tube car. Traveling to the Expansionary Defense Fleet headquarters, in contrast, required a family spaceship and a couple of days for the round trip. But it could be worse. 100 years ago, the new Patriarch had been required to present all those credentials in person. 500 years before that, a grand tour of all the Ascendancy's worlds and meetings with all the Myth Patriels had also been required. The Patriels now had to do all that traveling on their own, but the military still wanted at least a senior aide to make the journey to them. Maybe in another 100 years, the traditions would bend enough to allow all of it to be done via comm.
Before you leave, check and see if there are any documents that need to be taken to Naperar,
he instructed Thavik.
If so, you can save some courier a trip.
I'll do so, your Venerante, Thavik said. I'll be back as quickly as I can. In the meantime, do spend some time with the new files I sent you. There are a great many subtleties involved with your new position.
I'm sure there are,
Thurfian said.
I'll do my best to master them as quickly as possible.
I know you will,
Thavik said, bowing again.
Good day, your Venerante.
He left the office, and with a tired sigh, Thurfian turned again to his questus and the stack of files. Besides, even if he tried to push the expansionary defense fleet into promoting Thrawn, they probably wouldn't do it.
Chapter 3.
It took Bakif 3 days to finish interviewing the captains of the 3 groups of family warships that had been at Hoxim. He saved the Springhawk for last, partly because the ship was still being examined for damage, and he wanted both Thrawn and Simakro on hand at the Blue Dock to oversee the work, partly because he expected Simakro to finally offer him information he wasn't getting from anyone else. On that latter, at least, he was disappointed. It was clear that Simakro held crucial facts about the Springhawk and its participation that none of the family ship officers was aware of. It was equally clear that the Springhawk's first officer wasn't going to divulge those details without more pressure than Bakif was prepared to bring. It was also unfortunately clear that asking Thrawn those same questions would be a waste of time. Which didn't mean that Bakif wouldn't eventually get the whole story. That much he could promise himself. But right now, with the Syndicure buzzing like sting flies whose nest had been kicked, discretion was the better option. And so he contented himself with finishing his interviews, writing and filing his reports, and otherwise making the military side of the Hoxim issue as quiet and straightforward as possible. It was only when that was finished that he requisitioned a shuttle to Blue Dock 1, where the Springhawk was currently housed, to finally find out what Thrawn had wanted to tell him back at Spossia. It was quickly clear why Simakro hadn't been looking forward to the conversation.
"What in the depths of the chaos were you thinking?" Bakif demanded, as he stared in disbelief at the alien figure lying motionless inside the hibernation chamber. Not just in hibernation, but in hibernation in caregiver Thalius's sleeping room, in the Skywalker suite, supposedly one of the most secure places aboard the Springhawk.
"It was a humanitarian gesture toward the Magus's people," Thrawn began.
"I don't want to hear any excuses,"
Bakif cut him off.
"She was the cause of a death aboard the Springhawk," Simakro offered.
"I don't want to hear you quote protocols either,"
Bakif snarled.
For a long moment, no one spoke.
Bakif glared at Simakro, standing stiffly beside his commander, feeling a small pang of guilt at his outburst. From Simakro's expression, it was clear that he didn't approve of Thrawn's actions in keeping the alien aboard any more than Bakif did. And given Thrawn's past record on such things, Bakif was pretty sure Simakro hadn't been consulted about this decision before it was made. None of which altered the fact that he, Supreme General Bakif, was now sitting beside the two of them on the hot seat. Just the fact that the alien was here, in a close-orbit space dock with workers roaming the compartments and passageways, was enough to trigger alarm bells in the back of Bakif's brain. An accidental glimpse, a thoughtless word, and the cascade of repercussions would be felt all the way to the top of the Syndicure. What in blazes was Bakif supposed to do? He took a careful breath, forcing away the simmering anger and dismay. The problem was obvious. Time to find a solution.
"First things first," he said. "Who else knows about this?"
"Caregiver Thalius, of course," Thrawn said.
If he was concerned about the political ramifications they were all facing, he wasn't showing it.
"And Senior Captain Lakinda of the Grey Shrike. No one else."
"You mean Senior Captain Zyander?"
Bakif growled.
"She's been rematched to the Arisi."
"Really?"
Thrawn said, a flicker of surprise crossing his face.
"I hadn't heard."
Bakif looked at Simakro. He'd heard, Bakif saw, and from the other's expression, it was clear Thrawn's first officer had been working through the possible implications of Zyenda now belonging to the Myth family's most implacable rival. He was worried, and rightfully so,
With a secret like this hovering over them like an unstable breacher missile, they could only hope Zyenda's loyalty to the expansionary defense fleet surpassed whatever loyalty she felt for her new family. But there was nothing any of them could do about it. Again, time to find a solution.
All right, he said. So you think the Magus's planet, this Sunrise, is the key to all that's happened to the Ascendancy over the past year or so?
Perhaps not everything that's happened, Thrawn hedged. But certainly Sunrise and its resources were involved in the Agbui attempt to precipitate a civil war within the Ascendancy.
Yes, Barkeef murmured, suppressing a wince. Civil war.
He still had only pieces of the Hoxim story, but the fact that three members of the 40 had simultaneously invoked family emergency protocols carried ominous overtones. It might be that Thrawn was overstating the case. It might equally well be that the Ascendancy had narrowly escaped the kind of heightened internecine rivalry that in the past had sometimes led to armed conflict. Unfortunately, serious though that was, it wasn't as serious as Barkeef might have hoped. He needed a case strong enough to stand against the Sindicure, which meant being able to tie Sunrise and the Sleeping Magus to not only the Agbui, but also General Yiv, the Batatis, and maybe even the Vagari pirates. Because once the Sindicure was on board, the rest would be easy. A set of connections that strong would give the Council sufficient justification to authorize a mission to Sunrise. Not just a quiet intelligence-gathering probe like the one he'd sent Admiral Arulani and the Vigilant on, but a full-fledged military strike on whoever was parking battle dreadnoughts over the planet and taking potshots at every Ascendancy warship that happened by. But it didn't sound like Thrawn could make that case. And without it, there was little chance the Council would risk leaning over their legal limits any farther than they had already. In fact, if the Sindicure hadn't been distracted by this whole Hoxim fiasco, they might well have already come down hard on Barkeef and Supreme Admiral Jafosk for Arulani's quiet mission. And that grace period wouldn't last forever. For now, the 9 ruling families were exerting quiet pressure on their wayward allies in the 40 great families, working to resolve the conflicts and bury the messes that Hoxim had created. Whatever Barkeef decided to do, he had a limited window of opportunity before someone noticed and started screaming about it.
All right, he said. We all agree you need to get her back to her people. That much is unarguable. The question is whether you take the Springhawk to Rapak, or whether I dig up a scout ship that's not being used and put you and the Magus aboard.
Either would work, Thrawn said. In the latter case, would I also be allowed to take Skywalker Ciri?
Absolutely not, Barkeef growled.
Thrawn had gotten away once with taking the girl off on an adventure, but both the Council and the Sindicure had been furious about that, and neither body was likely to let him skate on it a second time.
You'd have to go jump by jump. Granted, it would take you longer, but I think I could get the Council to allow you a leave of absence.
Beside Thrawn, Simakro stirred.
With all respect, sir, I don't think a scout ship would be a good idea, he said. The enemy we faced over Sunrise could have traced the Magus as refugees back to Rapak by now. I don't think the Pakash are ready to deal with them, and a scout ship certainly won't be.
You're recommending he take the Springhawk, then?
I don't think it works any other way, sir,
Simakro said.
No matter what the repercussions, Barkeef pressed. And not just those that rain down on Senior Captain Thrawn.
Simakro's lip twitched, but his nod was firm.
Whatever the repercussions, sir,
I'm prepared to accept my share of them.
On one level, Bekeef knew, a casual acceptance of as-yet-undefined penalties was dangerously brash. On another level, it was exactly what he'd expected from an officer like Simakro.
Unfortunately, I have to agree with your assessment, he said. Very well, Senior Captain Thrawn. You and the Springhawk are hereby authorized to return the Magus to her people on Rapak. But...
he let the word hang in the air a moment.
You will then immediately return to Naperar for further consultation and orders. Immediately!
I had promised to return her and her people to Sunrise, Thrawn pointed out.
That's a promise you'll have to break, Bekeef said bluntly. I need you back as quickly as possible, before the Sindicure notices the Springhawk is gone and starts wondering loudly about it. That means no additional side trips.
Sir,
you did the Pakash a favor by taking her to check out the condition of her world,
Bekeef interrupted.
It's their turn to do one for us.
Thrawn and Simakro exchanged looks, and it wasn't hard to read their thoughts. The alien battle dreadnought the Springhawk had encountered had pushed even a pair of Chiss warships to the limit. Unless the Pakash were a far more aggressive species than had yet been demonstrated, they wouldn't have a chance against an enemy like that. But they knew an order when they heard it, and both were familiar enough with Bekeef to recognize that the time for discussion and bargaining was past.
Yes, sir, Thrawn said. The Springhawk's resupply is nearly complete, and the last of the on-leave officers and warriors are due back in 3 hours. We'll leave as soon as they're aboard.
Good, Bekeef said. Just get there and back as quickly as you can.
Understood, sir, Thrawn said. I'll escort you back to your shuttle, then begin preparations for departure.
Meet Captain Simakro can see me to the shuttle, Bekeef said. I prefer you get started immediately on departure prep.
A hint of a frown flickered across Thrawn's face, but he merely nodded.
As you wish, Supreme General. Don't worry. The Springhawk will be back before anyone misses it.
He straightened briefly and nodded, then strode from the sleeping room.
At your convenience, Supreme General, Simakro said, gesturing toward the hatch.
In a moment, Mid-Captain, Bekeef said. I have a question for you first. Aside from Senior Captain Thrawn, can you find out how many Myth are aboard the Springhawk?
5, sir, Simakro said. 1 junior officer, 3 warriors, and our Skywalker's caregiver.
Bekeef frowned. He'd expected Simakro to have to look up that information.
An odd fact to keep at your fingertips, Mid-Captain.
Not really, sir, Simakro said. I've long had the sense that the Myth Patriarch was working in the background to smooth Senior Captain Thrawn's path through the political brambles he so often gets tangled in. Now the Patriarch Thuraki has been replaced by Patriarch Thurfian.
He left the sentence unfinished.
An interesting conjecture, Bekeef said. The questionable aspect being the implication that a Myth Patriarch might stand against a respected naval officer of his own family.
Perhaps, sir, Simakro said. Questionable or not, though, I've been at enough Sindicure hearings to know how the aristocracy behave in public. The one time I was called in front of Syndic Thurfian, it was pretty clear he didn't like Thrawn very much.
I see,
Bekeef said. Personally, he would have put it a lot more strongly.
But Thurfian is patriarch now. His attitude and vision for his family may have changed.
Maybe, Simakro said.
but he also now has the ability to give direct orders to each and every Myth family member.
Yes, he does,
Bakeef murmured.
Unlikely he would do anything blatant, of course. Certainly not aboard an expansionary defense fleet warship.
I agree, sir, Simakro said. But it never hurts to be prudent.
Indeed, Bakeef said. But now, Mid-Captain, I believe my shuttle is waiting.
Yes, sir, Simakro said. At your convenience, Supreme General.
That one?
Thalias asked, pointing at the festive red and blue wraparound dress hanging on the rack.
You're sure?
Chiri's face screwed up in indecision, her eyes darting to the other three dresses hanging beside it. She'd tried on all four, and she clearly wanted all of them. But even 10-year-olds had to learn that life was limited and decisions had to be made.
Chiri,
Thalias prompted. The girl's expression cleared, and she nodded.
Yes. You're absolutely sure?
Thalias pressed again, smiling to herself. As the Springhawk's only two civilians, she and Chiri were supposedly allowed to wear whatever clothing they liked on duty. If Chiri had set out to deliberately test that freedom, it was hard to imagine that she could have found a better way to do it. Which was a pretty big leap all by itself. Up to now, Chiri hadn't shown much interest in clothing style, mostly dressing in functional slacks and shirts in the muted color palette that better fit in with the black uniforms worn by the Springhawk's officers and warriors. But now, suddenly, the girl had caught the fashion bug with a vengeance. Thalias had a fairly unlimited budget with which to buy Chiri's toys and art supplies, and in the past, the girl had taken full advantage of that largesse. But while such things could be crammed into drawers and under-seat storage, there was only a limited amount of space for clothing in her sleeping room's closet. Plus, of course, the whole life lessons thing. Thalias' internal smile saddened a little.